Absolutely. And he even, talking about those zoom ins, he even spends time zooming in on another geoengineering effort that I find interesting, which is trying to save the coastlines, at least to some extent, because there's a lot of time spent with this project that's going to keep the glaciers from completely collapsing. Led by scientist Pete Griffin.
Lois, Lois, we gotta save the glaciers, Lois.
He does actually, and dies in the process. I don't have a lot to say about that. It's just I wanted to note that there's a scientist named Pete Griffin who dies for no particular reason. I
And
thought it was going to be a conspiracy, but it wasn't. He just
the
died.
way and the way that like he that 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 he writes this stuff again, it's not just because you can imagine a schlubby guy from Quahog, doing this, right? It's written in a very conversational fashion. It's written in people, laughing through the sheer horror of what happens if they fail,
Yeah,
right?
guys who like spending time in the cold, on the ice, on the glaciers. Glaciologists seeing there being no glaciers anymore is an interesting perspective. And you see him spending time, jokes aside, about this character who shows up, his name Pete Griffin, and then dies in a snowmobile accident. And flops on the ground like Peter falling down the stairs, presumably. Jokes aside from that, you have these moments of like, there are so many people doing this work. There is so much work happening, and so many people are putting their shoulders to the wheel of history. In fact, at towards the end of the book, there is just a list of countries, and then just projects that were happening in those countries this whole time. And maybe a couple of them got mentioned, and hundreds of them didn't. This just long list of countries and the projects that were being undertaken in them.
You know
Things
who
like,
else? You know who else was in the business of listing countries?
who is that?
Our good friend Nikolai Carpathia.
That is true. And what I was going to say is, it what I was going to say is, of course, this is all a scheme by Nikolai Carpathia to climate change. The heat wave was conjured by Nikolai. Yeah.
Yes,
He
yes. If
tricked
Nikolai
you into believing in
Carpathia is
climate
the
change.
Antichrist, then Kim Stanley Robinson is the false prophet.
His name is his last name is Fortunato in the Left Behind series. He's I forget his first name, but his name is Fortunato, and he is cast
Yes.
into the pit of fire eternally, much like Frank briefly is, but
Yes,
perhaps.
this is now a Left Behind podcast.
Yes, this is because this has been the Left Behind corner. Okay,
Yes.
to move on though, this plot covers many years, and has these just independent instances of little things happening, be it the assassination of a particular oil billionaire, be it I think the what's the conference is that gets stormed by like
Davos, yes.
Davos? Yes, let's speak on that for a second. Davos gets stormed by whoever, this group of people that are like just decide to tell them off for a couple days,
Yeah,
and tell them your kids hate you and then
it's
leave.
so bizarre. It's so bizarre. And it's intentionally bizarre, right? I think it illustrates here the, well, I'll get into it. It's from the perspective of an attendee of Davos, the World Economic Forum held every year at the end of January, where all the power brokers, the stateless elites, right, they come together, or the captains of industry, the billionaires, all, the few hundred or so people who as a class are driving the immiseration and the slow boiling of the world, right? And they are held prisoner here by the shadowy, we don't even get a name for them. They're held prisoner by the shadowy, I want to say like vaguely, I mean, how would you describe their political tendency? They're not anarchists.
They're DSA tankies, I think. Somehow they're
Oh yes, the DSA's Terrorism Caucus.
I mean, like, actually kind of seems like it. Like they take control of Davos with guns, and then they kind of tell them off for a few days. It's interesting. And the exercise is not one of this is a realistic thing necessarily that could happen, and more of a exercise, I think, in okay, here's the futility of just lecturing a billionaire.
Yes,
He's already,
exactly.
by becoming a billionaire, he's already developed a certain level of cognitive dissonance that you are not going to break through.
Right. I mean, he says straight up, most of us were willing to listen to the propaganda of our captors rather than spend the day stuck in an empty room. You know, this is what it means to them, right? It's, you know, you'd rather just, you know, go through the motions, right? And which, again, you know, it's I mean, the purpose of re-education is not to make you a doctrinaire, you know, one or another, right? You know, it's just, can you function in a society? Can you put in the society that's trying to be built, right? Can you put in the work, right? And these guys aren't even going to do that, right? They're just, again, they're going to be let free in a few days.
Yeah, the guy describes it as like a cool vacation. And it's interesting because these people are really trying, and they even like pull out, like they have videos of some of the people's, there's kids. Like they're doing everything. They're doing the most, and it doesn't matter. Which is interesting because this book does not see this class of people overthrown by the end, necessarily. No.
They see them curtailed.
Yes, you know, it sees them, their wings clipped, I'd
yes,
say.
Yes, and their tax havens shuttered, right? You know, their loopholes closed, you know.
And I guess if you could pull off everything he does in this, that happens in this book, you could conceivably say, okay, that maybe would be sufficient to get rid of the bourgeoisie. I just don't think you could do some of the things they do in this book on a global scale.
Because, you know, it would be, you know, again, it's the difference between, you know, it's the difference between Britain nationalizing the Bank of England and, you know, whatever this is, right? You know, it's a group of people that's protecting their primacy versus a group of people willingly collaborating in their own sort of stepping down from the throne. There's a word for it.
Well, because a big part of the book is them trying to sort of negotiate with these big holders of oil and yes. carbon and mm-hmm. basically buy them off. And they do, essentially.
With carbon then, coin.
With carbon coin, which we'll get to in a second. But but then by the end, basically putting a very hardcore global maximum amount and thereby invalidating the sheer amount of money they were able to collect on. So the idea was that, and I think it was like some very large but not unbelievable amount of money that you could keep. And that was the idea. And I think in Kip Stanley Robinson's mind and in the world of this book, this generation of Davos bourgeoisie is just the last generation of bourgeoisie properly. Mm-hmm. There's an incredibly intense, you know, taxes that will take their wealth. If they try to hide their wealth, it's no good because everything's on the blockchain, not like Bitcoin. We'll get to it. But his idea is through this incredibly stringent regulation and that is accomplished very militantly on a lot of levels. He is accomplished with great pressure. They are effectively as a class defeated.
Yes.
That is the thing. It's just interesting because it does frame it as these people will not make compromise. And they kind of do, but I guess his point would be they are forced into that compromise very aggressively. In fact, all of the most egregious billionaires are, it says, dead by the like 2050. Like, he actually has a point where he tells the children of Kali, you can stop doing assassinations. Everyone who's responsible for the crisis is dead.
Which, you know, I wonder if that's not a wink to the, because again, you know, Robinson acknowledges, yeah, you know, this is the most optimistic sort of, lay of the land here that I'm sketching out, right? So, I wonder if it's not a wink to that, right? Because a whole lot would have to go right, including some people just disappearing.
Right. And there is one chapter of like describing a Children of Kali like operation sneaking into like a guy's home. I think this guy was actually a weapons contractor that they kill in that one, yes. But also responsible for climate change. Because unlike the characters in The President Is Missing, they understand why an attack would be carried out against a drone facility.
Mm-hmm. And they act accordingly. I was just listening back to that episode the other day.
There's a lot of references coming through this episode, but it's okay because we know everyone who's listened to this has listened to every episode up till now. No, I'm just kidding. It's totally fine. Welcome, first-time listeners.
Charles Dickens clawing at the veil of reality.
Mm-hmm. Y'all are, everybody is like, who are these references for? They don't know.
They're for you, dear readers.
They're for the real ones. They're for the day ones. All like which is both of us, I think, and my husband. Anyway, to bring it back around to Carbon Coin, Joss, do you want to explain Carbon Coin? Because it's weird. It is very weird.
Yeah,
but it's so interesting. I really think it's very interesting. But here, just go into it. Go into it because it's fascinating.
Yes. Yes. So it's based on a real life proposal, and it's essentially what it is a digital currency. And basically, you prove that you have sequestered carbon. You prove that you have drawn it out of the air, or you've stranded this asset of carbon. Right. You prove that you set aside this particular chunk of fossil fuel that's not to be burned, or that's been removed from the atmosphere. And on proof of that, you get a carbon coin. It's a new currency, and you can trade it in for other currencies. It's pegged to the dollar, so there is something material backing it. But it's not, I mean, the dollar alone is not going to be enough to back this based on the sheer size of the world economy. Therein lies the challenge, right? Because Mary Murphy now has to get the central banks of Europe, of China, and the United States. She keeps coming back to as like the big three that if just them got together, it could be done.
Which, like, to be fair, that's a heck of a lot of money right there backing up the currency. Yes. So I think it's basically the idea is if those three get in on it, it's like everybody else has got to hop on at that point. And China is... Okay, so China's role in the novel is it's unclear if China has necessarily surpassed the US, but it's I think seen as US is almost perfect equal in this book economically and materially in like just sheer capacity. And, you know, presumably is the leader of its own bloc. It doesn't go a whole lot into it, but you can kind of tell that that's happening. And so that's also part of the reason that China's involvement is so important. And so Mary is always, you know, negotiating, especially with the leader of the Chinese National Bank, and trying to get them on board. And Kim Stanley Robinson has an interesting relationship to China. And I apologize for getting too far off the carbon coin, but I do think it's important. His interesting relationship to China is he acknowledges the world has to become a lot more Chinese in the way markets are run. He explicitly says that in the book. I think he has a lot of skepticisms of China that may be unwarranted, but it is interesting because I think, like, despite himself, he has to keep coming back to it. And yeah, China has to be part of it. And yeah, their markets, actually, we've got a lot to learn from them. And I mean, I would say Kim Stanley Robinson is arguably like a market socialist. It's kind of strange that he has some weird beef with China, but anyway, the carbon coin, though, you explained it well.
Yeah, there's
I think you put it right.
Yeah, there's century bonds, guaranteed rates of return. That's what the central banks are.
And then anybody can collect on it for doing good work is kind of the idea. And
yeah, there's fractional carbon coin, notably.
And the idea, I think, is sort of the economy has always valued greed, and this would make the economy value something beyond just extraction. It would force, you know, economic investment in something good in a unique and outside the box way. I find it very interesting. It's the sci-fi brain coming and working. It's an interesting concept, and it works with the petro states, it works with the oil companies, and it works with characters like a guy who gets described, him and his wife working the soil and sequestering carbon and making a lot of money off of it and getting to have a nice little profit as a couple poor people who now have some like comfort out of that.
Yeah, it's described as a roundabout form of quantitative easing, right?
He loves quantitative easing as well. He's very interested in that. Which you know, you got to think about quantitative easing. Well, I'm not the guy to explain quantitative easing. But when this book was released, not when this was being written necessarily, because this was written mostly in 2018 and 2019, but when this book is being released, hell of a lot of quantitative easing going on, especially in 2020. Hell of a lot of these just massive government investments. And Kim Stanley Robinson has this concept of what those government investments could look like and how they could be structured, not just to give money to people, but to have different economic incentives, which is a way of shifting the way the economy functions. So it's not just redistribution.
Right. It's not just increasing the supply of money.
Right. He's not saying, okay, well, what if we made everyone a millionaire? He's a much more refined view of it than that. Again, not so sure carbon coin is going to be the way we do things. Not so sure it, but you know, you can see a world in which countries in a better world, whether it's a socialist world or not, or partially socialist world, or rising socialist bloc, or doing global economic incentives for the sequestering of carbon. Like, there's something there. And certainly him taking the blockchain and turning it into something that's not just pure crypto bro fantasy is at least appreciated, because it is a technology that will have relevance potentially at some point.
Yes, I admit I bristled on the first at first sight of the word blockchain, you know. But again, you know, there are use cases for it. You know, it's just the NFT bubble had to pop first.
Yeah. Sam. Interestingly enough, I was going to say Sam Bankman-Fried had to fall, but he hadn't even like risen when this book was written. He like rose and fall in like 2 years.
I mean, you know, it's the those things are just meteoric, right? In both directions. And
notably, his name is Sam Bankman-Fried, literally Bankman Fraud. It's unbelievable that this is real.
Bankman-Fried, Bernie Madoff, you know, like
the whole squad. Yeah, Mary Murphy.
It's the sort of thing that makes you think, okay, is somebody writing all this, you know?
A worse writer than Robinson is, I'll tell you that. Yeah.
Against the backdrop of the carbon coin, of the various proposals that Mary Murphy is trying to get rammed through in various political and economic arenas, we're running out of water in the United States. We're running out of water.
Let's see when that happens.
In the 12th year of continuous drought, our city ran out of water. It's not said exactly where the city is, but you can infer that it's somewhere in the either in the southwest of the United States, or even that's what I thought at first, but then I figured, okay, well, maybe it's in Britain, right? Because they have an extended kind of digression about Margaret Thatcher and how, you know, fuck her and everybody like her.
Is it not in UK?
It doesn't say it straight up.
I guess that's not the point, but
yeah, I'm not seeing, and it emphasizes as well, September 11th, 2034. So that's what kind of twigs me to, it maybe being American, because it's, you know, that date is significant to in the American memory, and it still will be at that point. But it's also,
never forget. They literally never do.
Yeah, you know, the overthrow of the Chilean government 50 years ago. Yeah. So it's a dangerous, and panicky moment, but it's also weirdly a moment of solidarity, right?
Yeah.
Because people are waiting in water lines now. There is water being trucked in, right? So people aren't going thirsty en masse necessarily. But here, it was sobering in all this to see how many we were. You congregate the whole population into just a few places, you see how many you are, and all of them strangers. In a city of a million, you know something like, what, 100 people? Maybe 500 faces, at most 1,000, so you know at most one person in 1,000. Walk into a full football stadium where you all have come to file through the line with your water jugs in hand or on dollies, water being so amazingly heavy, and you see that everyone there is a stranger. You are alone in a city of strangers. That's every day of your life. And there's a sort of joy and a sort of relief that Robinson's portraying here, right? You know, even though we knew it wasn't the total solution, not even close, as the drought was forecast to continue and we still didn't have a good plan, nevertheless, we danced in the rain, you know, because incidental rain has started to fall. And it's something that instead of people, you know, being at each other's throats about, that they can unite around.
Yeah, one thinks of, you know, the early days of COVID, original lockdowns, a lot of panic. There were scenes of, you know, real greed and clashing and stuff over, you know, limited resources. But one thinks of moments of just genuine solidarity that also came out of that. Moments where people were, you know, obviously we have our issue with the way that terms like essential workers and stuff were used, but there was you know, cynically, but there was a genuine heartfelt outpouring of support for people who were going out and working, of support yes. for medical establishment. Like, and that wasn't cynical from 90% of people who did it.
Yes.
99% of people who did it. There were communities coming together and sharing food and making masks for each other. And when there was disinformation, trying to help each other out and communicate. Oh, yeah. And it happened across the world. And in fact, much more impressive ways in some other countries besides the United States. I mean, you have in China, when the pandemic broke out, immediately over like a million people mobilized just to address certain needs around food.
Deliver food door to door to you know, administer tests, you know. Yeah,
you have Cuba sending you fleets of doctors around the world. I mean, you have, and this was done on multiple levels. You have countries, and this is even, you know, capitalist countries collaborating and for a moment forgetting about property rights to just come up with a vaccine. This is not the companies were not behaving this way, but the doctors were communicating mm-hmm. across borders. In fact, I'm sure more will come out on this, but there is word that apparently a lot of these doctors were clashing with the companies, doing their best to cross borders, to talk to sanctioned countries like Cuba, mm-hmm. who had information, to countries like China, who had information. You know, and you had this actual solidarity that emerged from crisis. And that's like such an important thing to remember. And you don't yes. see it in a lot of dystopian fiction.
Well, and I mean, you know what else happened in that first summer of COVID? You know, the biggest protests for civil rights against exactly police right. brutality in, you know, since the 60s and 70s, you know, tens mm-hmm. of millions of people out on the streets of America, you know, in the wake of George Floyd and all that. You know, it's people, you know, in many cases, people who had never even been out in the streets, you know, coming out.
I think the stat was over half of the people had never been in a protest so much exactly. as a protest.
Exactly. You know, yeah. but at that moment, you know, there was this mobilization of people who recognized, okay, you know, these, you know, my community, or, you know, people I know, people I love, you know, even total strangers who I want better for are under attack. And what they need is, you know, is my body out on the street, is out on the streets in solidarity with them. You know, it's, to the extent that there's such a thing as I mean, human nature is not immutable, you know, to the extent that there's such a thing, right? You know, I wouldn't describe people as inherently good or evil. I would describe people as inherently social, right?
Sure.
And it's amazing to see how that manifests. It's, you know, it's funny and notable, not only that, but like how quickly antisocial elements are rejected, because I love telling people about this. Like, it's common in like the cosplay, the nerdy circles that I run in on social media. You know, oh, you know, I'll add this person that I don't know. They might be a friend of a friend, but they're into, you know, cosplay, or, you know, the same cons I'm into, and maybe I'll run into them, right? If I know them on social media. You add people like that sight unseen, inevitably you're gonna get weird white nationalist types who worship cops. Inevitably, you're going to get like weird cranks who believe in like demon semen and whatnot, you know? And it's amazing to see everybody collectively realize, oh, wait, there's actually a whole lot of weirdos, and, you know, do a whole mass like cutoff of such people, you know?
Yeah, and that's a very real thing. Yeah, inherently social animals.
Yes.
You know, I remember reading an article about gorillas. And gorillas, there was this study done on when a certain gorilla starts to hoard all the food that the gorillas are eating, what happens? Typically that gorilla gets beaten to death. that tends to happen with incredible regularity. Another example of social animals. It's just thought came to my mind. But, you know, to get back, you know, to the plot after this moment of solidarity, and there are a lot of these moments of solidarity in the book.
Oh,
and
yeah, Frank's in jail.
He sure is. Frank gets arrested because, you know, Frank was doing all kinds of stuff. Frank was doing crimes, and then he started doing good things. You know, he started trying to help with some refugees, but he got caught, and now he's in like Switzerland jail, which is actually like pretty chill, apparently. Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, he, you see his heart's in the right place, right? Because, you know, there are these reactionary elements in Switzerland. There are these far right parties.
Yeah, it doesn't touch on them too much, but they exist. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, especially in like the more rural, like mountainous cantons, you know, they get kind of a foothold, at least initially, right, in this whole crisis, because you know, yeah, there are those, you know, antisocial, like more insular, you know, bigoted elements of, you know, of society, absolutely. And it's one of these, it's a group of skinheads from such a tendency that Frank fights, when they try to attack a refugee camp. And you know, he's and he does and he does and you know, he does the right thing. He gets in a fist fight with these people, but ultimately, yeah, he does get arrested because there's a warrant out for, you know, him killing the rich kid at the pool.
Yeah,
Sorry, the pool, the lake.
or the lakeside, yeah, from forever ago. So he goes to prison, and he's not really super important to the overarching plot for the rest of the novel. Mary visits him sometimes, have conversations. She, I think, sees him as sort of a sort of, it's like a weird sticking point in her mind, but it's this point in her life where she kind of got redirected, where she had a break with sort of these expectations, whether or not she definitely gets a lot more radical after her meeting with him. She gets a lot more, she's willing to go up against these powers that be in certain ways after her meeting with him. And I think she sees him as like important in that way. And Frank also is able to, there's like a bit about like Frank, like actually having like there being a prison that's not the worst thing that ever happened, like a genuinely more rehabilitative structure for how prison can be. I think, you know, Robinson wanted to spend some time with that, spend some time with, you know, just what Frank's conclusion is, because Frank's story is just not necessarily going to conclude at a happily ever after place. But it's not concluding in the worst place ever either. It's just a sort of the best trajectory he could have gone probably after what happened. Notably, there's a whole part, and I don't have that much to say about it. There's a whole part, and it's honestly my least favorite part of the novel, where like Mary is maybe going to get assassinated and people are trying to kill her, and she runs into the mountains and hides.
Oh yes,
And it's fine.
yeah.
I don't care for it. It's not really the point of the book to me. I think it's straying too far afield. This book doesn't do that kind of prolonged action well, in my opinion. I don't think it's abysmal. I'm just like, yeah, okay, sure, that happened. Mary's back. Let's get back to the politics. That's what the book's about. Let's get back to
Yeah.
riddles, and little stories. I like those better. So, like, do you have anything to say about people trying to assassinate Mary other than like, hey, it's the bad rich people doing the bad rich people thing?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like it's you know, you get a sense of the you get a sense of the ruling class fighting back, but you know, you really I mean, this is one part where my highlighting gets very, very scarce, right? Because it's a lot of dwelling on the it's a lot of dwelling on the scenery, right? It's a lot of dwelling on the environment, the glacier that and you know, credit where it's due, like reading about this, I'm genuinely uncomfortable, right? You know, are you
Oh,
familiar with
sure.
are you familiar with Adam Neville?
No.
He wrote a book called The Ritual, which got adapted into a horror film, and it's four guys on this four or five guys on this backpacking trip in Sweden, far north Sweden, above the Arctic Circle. So it's very, very cold, but also very, very dirty. You know, the grime, the insects about, you know, being unshowered and like unable to heal properly. You know, like you can splint something that's broken, but like you know, who knows if you're going to get to a doctor in a matter, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. You know, it's and you see that same sort of energy here when like here we go when Mary's having to climb across a glacier, right? That meant the pressure on her ankles was tremendous, and she found herself right at the edge of her strength, right on the brink of a fall, feet tilted this way and that in ways she never would have chosen. A couple of times her only recourse was to give away and step down another step, too fast, unconsidered, desperate. Every time that happened, her feet stuck in some new crack, an unexpected salvation. Fuck, she said, time after time. Fucking hell, it couldn't last like that. Some step was bound to go wrong. Her heart was pounding, she was sweating. Nothing else existed but this steep, broken staircase of cracked black rock. You know, I'm really not sure. I mean, it's visceral, certainly. But to return to sort of our gripes with it, right? I'm really not sure what Kim Stanley Robinson is doing here, other than, you know, like, okay, you're face to face with this thing that you're trying to preserve, and you know, you have to sort of reckon with it.
Yeah, you know, I guess it's that. And I guess he wanted to, I mean, he wanted to point out that there are these other, these counter forces and the, yes, and the implications of that. And I guess part of it is also just, you know, from a structural standpoint, breaking up the novel, doing, changing things that, you know, Mary has this life that plays out over years, and this is a thing that happens mm-hmm. within it. And it's certainly all well written. Like what you just read was, you know, it's very well written. I don't know, you know, takeaway wise exactly what to do. There's definitely some scenes up here in the mountains that I really like. There's one later on where Frank looks into the eyes of this animal. And mm-hmm. I like that a lot with, is it a mountain goat? It's something like that. Something I forget, like that. But there are like scenes like I do like the mountains as a backdrop to the setting of the ministry itself. And so, you know, he's moving around. There's some movement. There's some action. There's some actual Mary's life being in danger. Maybe he feels that's important. Maybe it's important to note that there is an active risk. She doesn't die. There is another member of the ministry who gets murdered at a certain point while visiting Russia. But there is this active violence. There is this low-level war happening across the world.
I think there is something to, before we get into the War for the Earth, I think there is something to the crawling across the glacier here, because because Robinson believes in a sort of degrowth oriented shift, right? And he believes
sort of not in the way that we maybe, I guess, before you go on, just for clarity for listeners who haven't read the book, not degrowth in the like return to like ancient times kind of degrowth that you might see online, a sort of radical degrowth. He means like, hey, we could all burn a lot less energy. We could whatever. Yes. Do we need this? Could we use sailing ships and take a little longer to get across the ocean? Kind of.
And following on from that, you know, we can congregate humanity in planned cities that take up a lot less space than like there is no urban sprawl in the world that Kim Stanley Robinson is building here, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry for interrupting, though.
It's an important distinction to make. And so that's the thing, right? In this new world that's being built, you know, we acknowledge that there are parts of it that simply are not for us, right? And I think Mary is being forced to come to that
conclusion, basically.
Well, I mean, no, because she's already at that.
That's true.
She's already at that conclusion, you know, but it's I'm still trying to turn it over in my head. I might just be reading too much into it, you know, because there is actually an in-universe reason for why Murphy et al. Would have to flee under cover of night across this glacier in, you know, why don't they just take the eagles out of the bunker, right? It's because at this point, warfare has been kind of democratized. You know, there are these multi-rocket launcher.
Weapons that come out of Russia, right? They're developed originally in Russia.
Yeah, they come out. Yeah, pebble mob missiles is the word for them. And you know, they're extremely extremely easy to build. They proliferate quite quickly, you know. And so, yeah, if they flee by some conspicuous means, then they're going to get shot down easily. You know, perfectly content with that explanation. But I'm a sucker for that extra layer of theme, right? I do like the idea that she's fleeing into this less hospitable world that she's helping create, and it lets her pass if only because she's helping create it.
That if that is indeed what he's doing with it, it makes me enjoy that bit more. I think that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting way of looking at it. I don't have a lot more to say on that, but that's something I'll turn over in my head. I'll have to think on that. I do want to talk a little bit more about the pebble mob missiles, though.
Yes.
To talk about that, it's interesting. I took a class in college called Global Challenges. Shout out to Dr. Gower. And we had an entire section on war and the sort of, you called it democratization of violence. Basically, there was a different term used, but it's basically that. The idea of increasingly cheap, relatively cheap weaponry. that can work vaguely autonomously or vaguely simply, smart weapons. In this case, a missile that like divides into a bunch of missiles that hit its target all at once from different directions. It's basically impossible to defend against, impossible to find the source.
It's like a handheld Jericho from Iron Man.
Essentially, yes. In this case, like in this class, we talked a lot about small drones that can carry very powerful explosives that have like rudimentary AIs and, you know, GPSs on them that can go places. You see those being used quite a bit right now in the Ukraine war on a large scale. These sort of drones. Obviously, there's the drones we think of that are just strike, you know, like predator drones, like strike drones, but also these sort of, you know, kamikaze drones. And those are used quite a bit in this novel as well. And the idea that you could as a relatively rich person, but not a nation state level resources, but, you know, a multimillionaire, billionaire could pull off an act of significant violence, and basically not be caught. Not in by significant violence, I don't mean like just having someone killed. That I'm sure plenty of billionaires could have people knocked off. But like being able to take action against a nation state in a violent way. And it in that case, it allows the most crazy elements of the society to do whatever they want. Hence the attacks on Mary Murphy, but also hence, you know, these climate justice groups, these more radical children of Kali type groups, downing airplanes and attacking coal plants. And so this is the kind of explanation for why you don't get a full-scale World War III, is that there just really is no way to properly fight it. Any ship is the easiest target in the world. No base can defend itself from it. The only way to win is not to fight. It's mutually assured destruction, but if everybody had a miniature nuke. I wanted to ask you, and I haven't come up with the solution in my own head yet, do you buy that? Do you think that this could stop a world war situation potentially?
It's certainly, to my mind, it seems to me to go away a lot quicker than I think it otherwise would.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's mentioned in, you know, chapter 69, nice, and it doesn't really come back again in a significant way, you know, because we have. Again, you know, we have the remnants we have the most reactionary remnants of the ruling class employing this, presumably. We have the children of Kali doing this. The book's missing that serious setback, I think, of seeing one of these projects just brought down by spite, you know? And, you know, again, Robinson's an optimist, but you know, and he does have those like make or break moments of, oh, we gotta make sure that the Arctic Ocean ice doesn't melt, or else the permafrost goes away, and then we're all fucked because all the methane, right? He has those moments of suspense, but we only really get those dark nights of the soul, I think, with Frank. You know, and not as a result necessarily of the forces, within those reactionary elements of humanity that would threaten, the rest of it. And you know, if indeed it goes that way, you know, if indeed we can have nice things, you know, and the people who are social are more powerful than the people who are antisocial, which, you know, I believe, you know, just perhaps not quite as cleanly. Well and good, right?
Right.
But it's just weird to me that this is kind of a blip in the narrative.
Yeah, I think it comes back to Robinson's personal distaste for the discussion of violence. None of his books like to dwell on it very much. Mm-hmm. It's not just him being like, hey, I'm afraid of people using violence to fight climate change. He just doesn't like talking about violence very much. It doesn't interest him, I don't think. So I think there's also, you also have to deal with that element. Like, I will say, like, there's a whole passage in, it's very interesting, in the Years of Rice and Salt, where you have this traitor in the Americas fighting his way down a mountain, and it mentions the fighting almost none as he fights his way down the mountain. Robinson doesn't find violence that interesting, I don't think. So I think part of that is not a political commentary. I think part of that is just who we're dealing with as a writer, like we were talking about earlier. On the other hand, I think maybe Robinson is drawing from this sort of theory of, you know, how people talk about how, like, well, there was no, the Cold War didn't become World War III because of nukes. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. It's kind of true, sort of, maybe. There's a lot of ifs and buts there,
right? But then, you know, but that deterrent element is there, right? You know, because I mean, you know,
but it is real, yeah. The deterrent is real.
I mean, just imagine what the period we know as the Cold War would have been like if the United States had indeed been the only country with nukes, right?
Yeah, or if even if there had been no nukes on the table, mm-hmm. I don't know what would have happened. Or you know, one could imagine presently. I have trouble thinking, I have little trouble imagining the U.S. would intervene in Russia right now if Russia was not a nuclear armed state. I don't know when you're listening to this. Hopefully the war is over, but the war is still very much going on in Ukraine as we talk. I hope I don't like laugh years from now because the war is still happening and say, oh, you naive person saying when the war is over. But all that is to say, there is a deterrent aspect, and I think he is acknowledging that. I myself am not quite sure. I guess one of those, we'll have to decide how good of a deterrent was when we see how history turns out, you know, mm-hmm. because the problem is it's one of those deterrents where when you have one slip, everybody dies. And I guess his idea with these pebble mob missiles is they're like nuke deterrents without the threat of complete human or almost complete human annihilation if there is an exchange. And notably, it can be limited primarily to military targets. I don't know, it's interesting. And it's an interesting technology, and one imagines like what a war in this world would look like. Oh, yeah. And there's certainly wars happening that we don't get a lot of focus on. I mean, there's a point where like the Saudi Arabian government is overthrown. Some kind of violence happens to transform Africa. There's certainly undiscussed, probably conflicts happening in India, undiscussed conflicts happening all over the world, no doubt. And it mentions we're in a time of troubles. It mentions there's a borderline civil war happening in Moscow.
That's the other thing, right? What keeps the Saudi Arabian overthrow, right? It's no longer Saudi Arabia. It's just Arabia, right? Mm-hmm. What keeps it from being a total deus ex machina is the fact that there is that economic incentive by that time, right? Because Saudi Arabia is potentially sitting on the biggest reserve of their proven oil reserves are massive, right? And what that potentially represents now, if they keep it in the ground, is the biggest single reserve of carbon coin, right, that they have access to.
Yeah, and it's worth noting there have been, you know, rebellions against the Saudi government in real life. 2011, 2012, and 1979. There were some pretty large scale uprisings that the US and Britain had to help put down. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on Saudi Arabia, but I have read that especially in the late 70s, without US intervention, the Saudis would probably have been overthrown. So, you know, one can imagine in a world where the US is, first of all, it's just power projection has fallen. Mm-hmm.
But also how it illustrates just how delicate that power is that they're projecting, right? Because, you know, what a sea change that would represent if one of the world's biggest petrostates overnight not only elected to keep this stuff on the ground, but also pledge the massive wealth that this represents to them to the development of one of the biggest solar arrays in the entire world.
Right. Right. And the solar arrays makes me think of some stuff in this book that I really love, which is these moments of little utopias, like these little moments like, hey, they're visiting India and seeing the stuff like this sort of green communal agriculture that they're making, or certainly like the last like fifth of the book or so, which is mostly just that kind of stuff.
There's a book called Climate Solutions Beyond Capitalism by Tina Landis, who's an organizer in a similar vein. And she lays that out, right? The projects going on in Portugal and Cuba and China, you know, Even in Montana, I think she mentions at one point, and it's like, look, there are people who are working on reforestation and rewilding and agroecology, right? You know, a less damaging form of agriculture that works with the local environment, right? There are these solutions that just haven't been scaled up yet, right?
And the book has, there's one part it has, it's like the Half Earth Project, which
yes.
By the end of the book, the Half Earth has not been achieved. It is on track to be achieved by some far late date, but the fact that people are trying is remarkable. What is the Half Earth Project, you ask? I'll tell you. The Half Earth Project is half the Earth, humans not living there. If humans go there, it's as visitors to interact as little as possible and to leave it to wildlife. This is not just a thing for the sake of endangered species, though it very much is for the wildlife to flourish. It is a thing that is also done for humans, because what are the greatest carbon sinks in the world? Well, it's obviously plants. It's obviously flourishing ecosystems. It's a funny conversation. You hear a lot, especially out of like Silicon Valley adjacent stuff, about carbon capture. We got to invest in carbon capture. You want to know a tried and true form of carbon capture? Fucking trees. And so they figure that out in Ministry for the Future. No offense to people researching carbon capture. Go for it. If you find out something better than trees, that's great. You haven't yet. And we know trees work. So plant some damn trees. They do that in this. They have in half the earth, at least it will be eventually, going to be for the trees, for the animals. And it creates, and it's a very beautiful and, you know, maybe it's one of Robinson's least realistic parts in this book. But again, let us dream, especially towards the end. Let us have this great vision of the future where there's even this part where, you know, Mary spends time on an airship flying over. I'm not quite sure how the airship works. Like it's some kind of blimp thing. Flying and looking over, you know, this just rewilded land. There's a pretty somber part about these people who are being paid to give up their land and their small town that they really love, but their sacrifices have to be made. And I actually appreciated that even with these great moments of great progress, building more efficient urban centers gonna suck for some people. Not necessarily in the, at gunpoint, we're driving. It's not like that. They compensate these people, but it's sad. It sucks.
Yeah, you know, it's people leaving behind their land. You know, it's people leaving behind their small town in which, you know, generations have grown up. You know, there is that painful goodbye that is inevitable, you know, necessary necessary in one way or another, in one milieu or another. But, you know, it's something that you can... It's something that you can build on, right? Because they say, yeah, you know, we're leaving our town, but we're going to set up in, you know, the same high rise, right? You know, our neighborhood is still going to be in close proximity. We're still going to be around people we know. It's just going to be, you know, more walkable, right?
Yeah. And it talks about that, and it's interesting. It's, you know, the uncomfortable parts of it. And
there are many aspects of it. We should, this is making me think of, we haven't mentioned Janus Athena yet, but they're pretty involved in a couple of things here.
Another bureaucrat at the ministry, basically.
Yes. Yes. And they are, they assist in building Yorlock, which is the new, the new social media, the genuine Facebook killer, right? That not only allows you to sequester your data and sell it to, you know, whatever institution for X amount of money, but it's also a way of regulating your personal regulating and storing your personal carbon coin as a medium of exchange in that sense, and it connects a wider variety of people than, you know, I think we're accustomed to in our current social media sphere.
Yeah. Tell me this. Did Kim Stanley Robinson predict X?
You know what?
No, this is not X. This is not Elon, whatever Elon is calling Twitter now. No one's ever going to call it that. No, but it is an interesting idea for this new sort of social media that's not owned by any one corporation. Yes, this is where Kim Stanley Robinson is getting very interested in like the capacity of social media for driving change and for driving, you know, conversation and creativity. He's surprisingly internet positive for a guy who I believe has no social media presence at all. He actually, I think he has very positive views about the potentiality of the internet. Mm-hmm. He just is like, yeah, it just can't be for profit. The algorithms have to be fundamentally different. He's right.
Right. You know, cause yeah, again, he does find that use case for blockchain, right? You know, this international financial regulation regime that's set up, well, you know, you have to have infrastructure for it. What is it? Oh, this perfectly, this ledger that's accessible by all the regulatory bodies, you know, regardless of country, right? Regardless of geography, right? You know, the technology for it exists, even if it isn't being put to that purpose, is his thesis here, and he's not entirely wrong.
What do you think the moderation's like on you, Locke? Because like, if you say something stupid, are you getting locked out of your bank account? Because I do have my concern.
And again, you know, define stupid, right? I personally think, I mean, it's. I would like to think that stupid encompasses, oh, you know, we should go back to burning tires in the back in our backyard and like, you know, rolling coal and all that, you know, like,
yeah, somebody's posting some stuff about how the mag will rise again. Instant block.
Yes. Yes, exactly. You know, but and, you know, in fairness, you know, there's only like ever 10 of those people in one group. Right.
That's true. Yeah. You don't have to worry about them.
But that's the thing, right? It's. There is an interconnection here that sort of exposes people to different ways of living, right? That exposes people, you know, what I said about the technology being there, even if it hasn't been synthesized or put to this purpose, right? There's a chapter in, yeah, chapter 76 here, right? Where somebody from the U.S. Navy says, yeah, you know, we have this frame of reference for, because Kim Stanley Robinson very correctly says that inequality is a major driver of, you know, is a major driver of human misery and of poverty, of climate change, no and doubt. All that. And so here comes this Navy person who's like, yeah, I have a frame of reference for things being not that way, right? Because the wage ratio of the Navy, they say, is 1 to 10, right? You know, the highest ranking person in the Navy, their salary is only 10 times that of the lowest ranking person, and enough times 10 is fucking luxurious, as this person says.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Hoorah, as that chapter ends. It makes me think of, forgive me for referencing this guy, because he's a real piece of work. But have you ever heard of Scott Galloway?
I'm not familiar.
He wrote a book called The Algebra of Happiness that's actually pretty good, even though he's a real dumbass. He was main character of Twitter for a day one time. When he made a post saying, every time I vote, I think about the people on the flight on 9/11 that voted to fight their captors and drive into the ground. And we're doing something similar every time we vote for president. He's a real dumbass, not kind of harmless as a dumbass. Like, that's not offensive or not exactly like, not like a right wing crank or anything. It's just like, what the hell are you talking about, bro?
Oh, God.
Very funny. So but he wrote a genuinely good book called The Happiness Equation, mm-hmm. That proves, and he spends a lot of time proving what makes people happy. And one important part of it is economics. And he says, first of all, dispense with the idea that money does not bring happiness. To a certain extent, that is bullshit. If you are poor, that is going to hurt your happiness. He mm-hmm. makes that point. He says, what doesn't bring happiness is exorbitant wealth.
Yes.
And he proves it's a certain number in like, it was like $102,000 or something a year. And wherever he had some test case was like the point where there is not going to be any returns after that. If you make more money, it is not on average going to make you happier. That's this equation in this book, in this particular time. This is not me going on the record saying, oh, if everyone made $102,000, we'd all be happy. My point is he finds a place that was actually beyond enough. It was, you can afford to save a little money, take a vacation now and then, get some stuff for yourself, but you are not dominating other people with that amount of money. That was his point. And he proves it, you know, mathematically. $102,000 sounds like a lot of money to me. It is a lot of money, but his point is it's not. He says, if you triple that, people on average don't actually get happier when they triple that, when they quadruple that. But people, he says, people on average that go from 50 to 100 a year do get happier. That was his point. And it's correct because of the comfort and the stability that brings. And this book, and I think that's, and I
So he's a Paul Cockshott sort of guy, right? Who's providing a mathematical foundation for this sort of, for advancing this theory. Mm-hmm.
And I say all this to say, Robinson talks about happiness and stability, and it made me think of that. And I'm going to listen back over this, and if this doesn't make any sense, I'll just cut it. But it's been eating at my head ever since earlier you talked about the happiness index, so I just said it. I don't know. What are we talking about now? I'm so far off. God, Scott Galloway he wrote that book and then he did nothing but inoffensive, stupid, not stupid stuff. That's just completely inoffensive from there on out. Nothing bad. Just like, what are you talking about, man? love that guy. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is, I think what I said earlier about Frank being the only point where, you know, you experience that sort of dark night of the soul in the narrative where you kind of see that doubt. There is that one refugee that we keep going back to, whose perspective we keep going back to, who finally gets out after mm-hmm. almost 10 years in a refugee camp.
Yeah. The Dark Knight Rises of the soul.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Basara, basara, desi, desi. Yeah. Yeah. But no, it's, so there is a,
that part's cool. I like
there
that
is a,
part.
There is a global sort of, yeah. Yeah. When they climb out of the well. Yeah.
I meant the refugee camp, but that too.
Yeah. Yeah. When the global passport system is instituted. Right. And it's a universal agreement that, okay. Like if you're a climate refugee and there are tens of millions of such people, you have the right to settle in any country you want. You'll have a guaranteed job, guaranteed home. And this is the way that the international community repays its debt to you. You know, there is that turn from stagnation, you know, from this character says, you know, 3,352 days being proof that things don't change. There is that turn from that stagnation to finally that relief. There is, but it's interposed, it's not back to back, the chapters are, but there is a series of turning points in chapter 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, right, where the refugee crisis is solved. The geoengineering process with the glaciers does begin to bear fruit, right? They simply run out of water below the glaciers to pump back up to arrest their movements. So, you know, they've done all they can do, and what they can do is working. The global stocktake of COP 58 concludes that yes, indeed, the CO2 content of the atmosphere in parts per million is going down. It's not immediate. It's going to take several more years, decades even, but it is going down from its high of 475, I think it was in the book, to 470 for the 460s. It's well on its way back down towards our current, I believe right now we're at 420 or so. Nice. Not nice, but
I was gonna say what?
it's 420. It's
certainly blazing.
Long walk for a short, yeah. Long walk for a short drink of water from the water lines, truly.
Yeah.
But yes, no, it is trending down. And amid all these glimmers of hope, where once there was nothing happening, Frank dies. You know, he's been diagnosed before this point with, I believe it's a brain tumor.
Yeah.
And there's this exchange that, finally, I think he has with Mary, where this is going way, way back, right? But he remembers at one point attending this kind of pageant in India where he's working, where it's a scene from the Mahabharata, right? And this guy's about to be killed, but he says, it's only fate, right? And he strikes one blow from seeming paralysis before he is, you know, struck down, right? And he carries that sentiment with him through the book, and it sort of develops from this fatalism to this acknowledgement that, well, okay, if you're fated to die, you know, you might as well go down swinging, right? And what Mary tells him ultimately is there's no such thing as fate. Right? There's no such thing as fate. And, you know, these things can change if only you do, you know, if you do go down swinging, you know, there is a non-zero chance that you will strike the fatal blow against your attacker.
Yeah.
You know, and that, and that, that sum up there really is, it's beautiful, you know, and you told me once that this is the most one of the most hopeful books that you'd ever read. And, you know, it's right here that comes to fruition.
Yeah. It makes me think of, and they've got these, you know, really beautiful moments where Frank, you know, out of prison goes and visits the mountains and spends time with animals. And he's able to sort of see this world, new world being born. And it's sad because he had this little part in bringing it about. One might say a huge part in bringing it about through his pressure on Mary. We're not sure what Mary would have done without Frank's, you know, kicking the ass, but he gets to sort of Moses, like, see the promised land, but never enter. He doesn't really get to live in that beautiful world. I mean, he has as far as things might have gone, he has a better life than he might have, but he dies and he doesn't see that, but he's able to find some measure of peace and he is able to, you know, reconcile mm-hmm. with his world. And, you know, obviously nature is important to this book because it's about nature. It's about, you know, the ecosystem and coming to that relationship with nature where you're not really striving against it. You're working with it and you are of it and you realize you are part of it. As Kim Stanley Robinson said in an interview, he likes to write on his back porch because he likes to remember he's always in nature. And he says, I am when I'm in my office too. I can just kid myself, you know, you're always in nature. You're in your nature if you're sitting in downtown Manhattan, you know, but that peace with nature and the book being about humanity as a whole, finding that peace and Frank as a microcosm of that, coming to that relationship with it. And Mary, not too long after that, also kind of having that relationship, both her retiring from her position, taking sort of a back seat, spending time traveling the world, seeing the world that she's been able to build, having these little experiences of, yeah, we don't cross the ocean quite as fast as we used to, but wow, I'm really quite enjoying this. Having a little romantic relationship with this captain who flies an airship and it doesn't really need to go anywhere. That's not really even the point. It's just nice. And it having this ending that is not this momentous, everyone standing on top of the mountain holding up the flag of the new earth, because no, that doesn't happen. You have new challenges. It even says at that COP conference, them saying COP, whatever it is, 50 something, Sim saying, yeah, we still need to work about, there is still inequality. There is still, I mean, we're not at pre-industrial levels on climate change. There are species lost. There is still violence against women. It talks about that, but it's on the right trajectory and the world has agreed to adopt or start to adopt economic systems and social systems and incentives where it is incentivized to work to build a better world mm-hmm. and the problems are largely acknowledged. And like you were saying earlier, utopia is collective struggle towards something worth living. That's awesome. It's beautiful. It's incredibly optimistic. And it ends in this very like soft, nice, beautiful place that is very comforting. And, regardless of any sort of disagreements on political economy, I think Robinson really gets it on a lot of things that we are trying to build.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I really appreciate about this book.
To drift back to that interview one last time, you know, he directly denounces class collaborationism, right? He directly denounces the idea of the end of history. You know, I really do like this. He says he uses optimism as a kind of club, right? As a form of anger, you know.
Sure.
To again, you know, you don't get more club like than the heat wave in India that kills 20 million, right? It's because that's the thing. It's in order in order to believe that the best is possible, you know, you have to acknowledge that the worst is also possible, right? You know, the worst is all, you know, the worst is also possible, and it can happen. And you know, maybe the best won't, right? But you can sure as shit prevent the worst. Mm. You know, and you're obligated to, I would say, as an inhabitant of this world.
Absolutely. Or, you know, to put it more succinctly, scrap like Frank, think like Mary, scheme like Badim, and fuck like that airline captain. I don't remember his name.
I think his name was, what was it? Oh yeah. Rayford Steele.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's actually the takeaway. I mean, I should make
it like Rayford. Fuck yeah.
Fuck like Rayford. He has two wives. This has been a return to the left behind corner, but yeah, no, absolutely. The jokes over sincerity aside, that is what I really love about this book. I think it's, you know, very clever in a lot of ways. It's got a lot of moments I really like. But ultimately it is that outlook that's important. And I think it's a term I'll never forget, is saying, I'm not utopian, I'm anti-dystopian, with him talking about when he writes about good things. I'll never forget that, because that is just so different. Being anti-dystopian, mm-hmm. having revolutionary optimism is inherently different than being just a stupid idealist who says, yeah, everything will be fine because it'll be fine. That doesn't make sense. Someone who says everything always works out in the end, that's not true. Everything doesn't always work out in the end, but it can if we make mm-hmm. it work that way, and it has to be achieved through struggle. And, you know, so there's really so much, so many little things that happen in this book, things I like, things I don't like, weird stuff about China that I don't really care to get into too much. I don't know that you do. I think it's fine. There's little things here, little things there. There's disagreements I have. There's moments I really like. Like, we didn't even talk about, there's a massive student loan strike that like helps cripple the parts of the economy. There's basically a second Paris Commune at one point. There's just things here and there that happen. There's just so many little moments from this book that exist in my head that I like will come back to, and I'll see parallels to, that I find, you know, really interesting.
It's very much, it's sort of an Occupy en masse. Yeah. That he alludes to happening throughout the world, which again, you know, we have actual Occupy, right, as a case study in why that sort of leaderless movement, you know, the challenges that it might face, you know, fatal challenges even. But again, you know, we're reading this book to see the world in which these things work, right? And to strive for something that, you know, isn't that, but, you know, achieves a collective solution nonetheless.
Absolutely. And so at the end of the day, it's important to think about those collective solutions. It's important to think about what a future can look like. It's important to think about how we can accomplish those things, both using tactics from this book and not, both, you know, pulling from obviously theory, pulling from our own lived experiences. It's important to organize, be the people on the ground bringing these movements about. Kim Stanley Robinson does not have the time to explain how every single movement in this book came about, how every single thing happened, but it's people on the ground doing things. Like I said, there's a list of hundreds of projects happening. We only see a small amount of that. Be part of those projects. It only can happen when it is brought about collectively. And that is what's so important. And then telling those little stories is, of course, so important. But just because we hear the story of the one girl who's helping in LA doesn't invalidate the story of the guy in, I don't know, somewhere else in the world that's saving someone else from a storm or from a heat wave, or the people that are delivering water to the migrants, or whatever. There's so many little things that are happening. And I think it's important to know those little things aren't little. We're all part of them. Mm-hmm. We all can be part of them. And an anti-dystopian world requires that kind of mass collaboration. It is a class project at the end of the day.
Yes. Fight the atomization, fight the depoliticization, you know, and despair is a very easy thing to come to. You know, I've dabbled in it myself. You know, I'm a reformed doomer. Frank is the reformed doomer in all of us. And that's the thing, you know, doomerism is, I mean, like anything, like utopia, it's a phase. It's a process, right? And there is an end.
Absolutely. Well, that more or less concludes my thoughts on the book. Joss, you got anything else you want to touch on?
Yeah. I mean, no, not really. I have Years of Rice and Salt sitting over there on my bed, and I'm going to get around to reading it eventually. But this is definitely not going to be the last Kim Stanley Robinson. While we're talking about longer series, we might dive into the, I would love to dive into the Mars trilogy at some point. That's the work of several episodes, of course.
Yeah, that would be a bit, a piece of work to be sure, but in a great way. Mm-hmm. Be interesting. There's a lot of interesting politics and ideas and stuff floating around there. It's like we probably need some kind of a guest versed in those books to bring on for that one, I do think. But we'll appreciate everyone for listening. And at the end of the day, my last thing I really want to note is airships. We got to bring them back, folks. Planes, they're done. We're gone. We're done with them. We're not doing planes anymore. We're not doing them. We're done with planes. We're done with birds. We're done with drones. They're gone. Airships, they're back in. So if any of you have come up with airship technology that does not require us using our limited supply of helium, I would like you to email us at thesocialistshelf@gmail.com and send me the schematics you have made for your airship. Also send us an email there if, you know, you just want to send an email. I got a very nice email the other day from someone saying I really like the show and I appreciate it, and y'all made me pick up a copy of The Jungle, and I thought that was cool. So, and you know, that's what we're here for. So, yeah, much appreciation to all the listeners. And Joss, you got anything else to close us out? Or
yeah, absolutely. Appreciation to all the listeners. Appreciation to all the, you know, all the correspondence that comes our way. You know, please keep it coming. Except for the people who want to explain to us the difference between a blimp and a dirigible. I have no patience for that.